Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
This is Tim Staples of Catholic Answers. I'm excited to let you know that I also teach high school apologetics for homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. There are also recorded independent learning courses at homeschoolconnections.com. Whether you take apologetics with me, literature with Joseph Pierce, or philosophy with Bill Donahue, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, it's a great way to get Catholic learning for your family.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the program. My name is William Hemsworth, and thank you for joining me on this episode. I'm very pleased to have my guest, Father Boniface Hicks. He's a Benedictine monk of St. Vincent Archabbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. He's the co-author, along with Father Thomas Acklin, of the book Spiritual Direction and Personal Prayer. He has provided spiritual direction for many men and women, including married couples, seminarians, consecrated religious, and priests. He is the programming manager and on-air contributor for We Are One Body Catholic Radio and has recorded thousands of radio programs on theology and the spiritual life. He has extensive experience as a retreat master for laity, consecrated religious, and priest. He is the director for spiritual formation for St. Vincent Seminary and director of the Institute for Ministry Formation and has offered numerous courses on the spiritual life. Father Boniface, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you. Great to be with you.
That's great to have you with me. And congratulations on your book, Through the Heart of St. Joseph.
Thank you. It's a labor of love over the course of a number of years, and just happy for the Pope to give us a year of St. Joseph that kind of gave me some motivation to bring it to conclusion. And so grateful to Emmaus, who rapidly put it into print.
Great. So what I guess I want to start off, and I know this isn't a competition by any means, but what makes your book different from, say, the ones by Father Calloway or Mike Aquilina?
Well, that's a great question. And both of them endorsed my book, which I'm grateful for. And I endorsed Father Calloway's book, too. A number of the endorsements were just included on the website, but he sent me an advance copy and asked for my input on his beautiful book. I love his book. And then Mike Aquilina's book also is excellent and takes things from a little different approach. Mike Aquilina's book looks more at the historical and patristic foundations, brings us into the context of the times that St. Joseph lived in, and helps to set up some of the different questions about St. Joseph. It's a little book. It's very readable, and it gives us some of the approach that Mike does so well in looking at those patristic sources. Father Calloway's book, I like to describe it as the stuff every Catholic should know about St. Joseph. He sort of establishes the foundation of what everybody should know about St. Joseph. He gives us really kind of bread and butter, meat and potatoes, goes through all of the really trustworthy parts of the tradition, weaves together the different themes, and paints a really accessible picture of St. Joseph that I think should provide the baseline. There are a number of sort of distorted images of St. Joseph that have arisen at different times, and just because there hasn't been much reading or really kind of system comprehensive writing about him that's been accessible to people. And I think Father Calloway's book, presenting it in the 33-day structure, which seems to be the flavor of the Marians. He and Father Michael Gately have made a mint on 33 days to everything. But it's a wonderful way to just take a bite-sized piece and even have regular meetings around these themes of St. Joseph. And I have to say, I'm the spiritual director for St. Vincent Seminary, and we have diocesan as well as Benedictine seminarians. And I led our seminarians through the 33-day consecration this spring. And I think it's a wonderful structure, format, great material. So I like to describe my book as anyone could read, but I also think it really follows nicely after Father Calloway's book as well, as sort of 2.0, if you will, okay, of taking you into how to really develop a relationship with St. Joseph. There's the information about St. Joseph is really important that Father Calloway provides, but what is it? How does it correspond to things in us? And how do we develop the attitudes in prayer, the interiority to interface, to relate, to connect with St. Joseph? And so I provide 5 pathways by which we can come to know St. Joseph and relate with him. And then also a sort of 6th chapter on how we can cultivate environments that other people can meet him and we can share him. And so I would say that nuance, and another way to look at it, as you mentioned, one of the other books that I've helped to write is a book on personal prayer. Father Tom Acklin and I, from years of spiritual direction with hundreds of people, have had a sense of how the spiritual life develops, not only from the objective perspective of Catholic teaching, which we do, but also from the personal experiential perspective of the individual prayer. And so another way to look at my book would be an application of personal prayer to a relationship with St. Joseph, which just takes everything a little bit deeper into the spiritual life, I would say, than some of the other books that I've come across.
Okay. Now, in your introduction, you describe the slow development of devotion to St. Joseph. Can you go into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, it's taken centuries. Well, a millennium and 2 millennia in a certain sense. There's the first, of course, we have the seeds in sacred scripture. So I don't want to make it look like it just arose out of nowhere. I mean, really, in terms of characters in scripture, nobody gets that much writing about them. And certainly in the New Testament, I mean, so many of the apostles have literally their name and maybe one sentence that they said, and that's the entirety of their personality that we right. have. And these are the foundation stones of the church. So we shouldn't be so surprised that there's not too much written. And in comparison to them, there's quite a bit written, in fact, about St. Joseph, especially if you understand the depth of the meaning of some of the words that are there, when he's called a just man, for example, or the way that it describes his response to the dreams, word for word, the same as what he was told to do. We see the level of his obedience. And so we get some pictures about him, and then we can derive some things theologically about him. But from that seed base in sacred scripture, really a large part of 2 chapters of Matthew and 2 chapters of Luke's gospel is about the whole corpus of teaching on St. Joseph. And then there's some writing in the fathers of the church about him, especially some critical questions. Was it a real marriage? St. Joseph is son of Eli in one genealogy, and he's son of Jacob in another genealogy. Like, how do you work that out? What were his thoughts when the angel came? So some scriptural questions, kinds of things that are important to the fathers of the church as they were laying the foundation of how we interpret the sacred scriptures. And then in terms of devotion, there was a lot of focus on Our Lady, understandably, because she is the center of the church, and she is the perfect disciple, and she is the model for us. And so she's the way that we're really going to engage the Lord and the mystery and everything else. And that was a large focus for a number of centuries. And St. Joseph just had this very background position. And then there are some surges up. Just before 1000 AD, there was the first feast day of St. Joseph. There's a little bit of debate about what was first, but I like the side that says the Benedictine monastery was the first one to have a feast day to St. Joseph. So I'm going to claim a little Benedictine primacy there. But then really centuries go by, and St. Teresa of Avila in that time period, 1400s, 1500s, started to see a new resurgence of St. Joseph. St. Francis de Sales did a lot of writing. There were some homilies given at the Council of Trent on St. Joseph that were very important. And then the introduction of more sort of feast days, devotions. But then we really begin to catch some momentum with 150 years ago, which is why we're celebrating this year of St. Joseph, 150 years ago, Blessed Pius IX declared St. Joseph the patron of the whole church. We have patrons of lots of things, from trees and foresters and cancer patients and addicts and everything else. But St. Joseph is the patron of everything. He's the patron of the whole church, and he's the only one. And Blessed Pius IX acknowledged that privilege of St. Joseph. And then we had a cascade of writing. Every pope since then has written something significant, published something significant, provided some devotional edition or enshrined in some feast day, has done something significant. And now this year under Pope Francis, we have a pope who has a symbol of St. Joseph in his coat of arms, who was inaugurated on the solemnity of St. Joseph, and who has written a number of things about St. Joseph, and then has declared a year of St. Joseph. So we have a lot of things that have come together in Pope Francis. Pope Benedict, who is named after Joseph in his baptism, also with a lot of devotion, beautiful teaching. And Pope John Paul, before him, wrote the longest magisterial teaching in the Guardian of the Redeemer. So really a lot of momentum right in our time. And this year of St. Joseph is a kind of culmination of some of that.
Okay. In chapter one, you have a section about protecting the vulnerable. So what can we learn from St. Joseph in regard to protecting the vulnerable?
Well, as I mentioned, the purpose of these different chapters is really to help us to cultivate certain attitudes that will help us to connect with St. Joseph. And so when we look at St. Joseph as protector, how do we personally come to know St. Joseph as protector? By giving him access to our vulnerability, we could say. It's really by learning to be vulnerable, by taking a risk, as Our Lady did when she said yes to the angel and took the risk of this supernatural vocation in which she would be quite unprotected. And she had to entrust herself to St. Joseph. The way that he protects is through a way of hiding, not through a way of fighting. So St. Joseph protects through humility and obedience and silence, and he does what the angel tells him to do. He does what the Lord tells him to do. When Herod raises up, slaughters the innocent, St. Joseph doesn't raise up an army, but he obediently disappears into Egypt. And then likewise, there's a beautiful text from Ignatius of Antioch that Origen, that father of the church, references when he says that the very fact of Joseph marrying Mary was protecting the Holy Family from the devil, who was looking for a virgin, not a married woman. And the devil can't see in the order of grace, so he doesn't see the holiness, but he's scanning the earth looking for married women. And that's why he didn't even know that the child was being born, except that the Magi tipped off Herod, who was clearly very well acquainted with the enemy. And the enemy could work in him to send him into a rage and try to slaughter the innocents, but still blindly. He didn't know who he was striking after. And so Joseph provides a veil, and that's the image that I offer in the text through the heart of St. Joseph. And I think a beautiful image for us to think about it, what a veil does. A veil signifies something beautiful. It both reveals and conceals. When we see a chalice veil, or when we see a veil on a bride, or a veil on a nun, or a veil on a tabernacle, when we see veils, we know there's something holy, something beautiful beneath that veil, but it also protects the details of whatever that beautiful, holy thing is. And St. Joseph provides a veil that those who have eyes to see and know there's something beautiful underneath, but those who don't have eyes to see just kind of walk by. And that's what we see in Nazareth for 30 years. Nobody had any idea that the Immaculate Conception and the Incarnate Word were living next door.
Right.
St. Joseph veiled the Virgin and child from those who wouldn't understand until the time was ready. And then he really recedes, his role kind of disappears. But to come back to the purpose for us, there are places in our hearts that need to be veiled. They need to be revealed. Somebody needs to see them. And this is, you know, what we talk about in our spiritual direction book, of course, is spiritual direction, confession. These are the places to reveal, but we want confession to take place in a confessional. We want a seal of confidentiality on spiritual direction. And we can expect that also from St. Joseph. He's a father who can really receive our secrets, We can share everything with him, and we can know that he keeps it absolutely safe and loves us in it.
Okay. Now, in addition to all the great information you have in the chapters, each chapter ends with a prayer. So what was the process like of going through and selecting those prayers?
Well, I have to admit that was part of the feedback from the book and also part of my inspiration from Father Calloway. One of the things that I find very beautiful about his book and some of the other 33-day books was that combination with prayer. We need more of that, not just a lot of ideas and talking. And I'm always in danger of that, too much talking and too little praying. But I wanted to add that back in just to sort of bring some of those concepts together in prayer. And I also wanted to choose prayers that had some depth in the tradition. I think that there's a lot that's pious, popular piety really captures elements of teaching and evangelization that are really important. And we can kind of hold on to in our prayers some of these beautiful things. So I also wanted to pick prayers that were meaningful to me and that I myself had prayed, not just to pull out an idea, but actually, and I would say that for the whole book, everything I wrote in the book was something that I took into prayer and really could feel resonated within me. None of it was abstracted intellectualism. That's just very important for me. And maybe it's my own personal dangers to get a little too much in my head. So I wanted to make sure I could take all of it into my heart. And those prayers were the same way. Looking through the tradition, I looked at some different sources, but then it's things that I prayed with myself and felt that would be beneficial for other people to capture some of those themes and open their hearts to the Lord.
Okay, great. Now in chapter five, you have a section describing St. Joseph as the new Abraham. And maybe some may not be familiar with that. Can you describe how he is the new Abraham?
Well, I have to give credit to Abbot Bonowitz, Bernard Bonowitz, who I got that idea from. He's a Jewish convert who became a Cistercian, a Trappist at Genesee Abbey, and then was made an abbot of a Trappist monastery in Brazil and wrote out retreat conferences. One of his dear friends is one of my directees, and so he gave me a copy of the conferences, and it was one of the points he makes that I found very inspiring, and I wanted to include it and develop it a little bit. One of the ways that we can see St. Joseph as a new Abraham is in seeing Jesus as a new Isaac. Of course, Isaac, who was the sacrificial son, the only begotten son who was offered by Abraham, but no, God stopped him at the last minute and promised that he himself would provide the lamb for sacrifice. And so we know that in Jesus, we have a new Isaac. So the father of Jesus becomes a new Abraham. That's one approach. Another approach is in the genealogy. It says this is in Matthew's gospel. This is the genealogy of Jesus, son of David, son of Abraham. So again, the significance of him as son of Abraham is brought out there. And of course, then he's also, as the genealogy goes on, a son of Joseph. But then to see the qualities of Joseph together with Abraham, Joseph also, in a way, offers his own son and has his own sort of perpetual virginity as you know, Abraham, of course, conceives a son, but not till he's 100 years old, right? He lives most of his life as a sonless father. Mm-hmm. And Joseph, in his, you know, kind of virginity, is also a sonless father who is then given a son as a gift and is able to care for Jesus, the son of the promise. The true son of the promise, like Isaac. But also Abraham is called to get up and leave his comfortable place of living and go to a place that God would show him, and also has his sort of place in Egypt and has that whole journey. So this obedience of Joseph responding to the call of God to take his family to this place that God would show him and stay as long as God wanted him to, is an Abrahamic kind of movement. And then we also see, I got this insight from Pope Francis, when Joseph is struggling with his doubt as he wonders whether he's really worthy to be part of this whole process, and he's thinking of separating himself from Mary, Pope Francis points out that this would be an Abrahamic sacrifice. Sometimes we have this misconception of Joseph sort of being full of himself and saying, oh, you know, she's like not good enough for me anymore. At least I'm too good to kill her, you know, so I'll just like send her away. But the scriptures and the tradition really give a very different presentation. He loved her. He knew she was all beautiful. He would have known her holiness to a greater or lesser degree. He trusted her, and he simply knew that something was happening there that was beyond his pay grade, that was a mystery that he couldn't comprehend, something that he felt unworthy to be part of. And so his decision to separate himself was not a trivial decision that he took on lightly, but rather, as Pope Francis points out, an Abrahamic sacrifice. She was the greatest treasure of his life. She was the greatest gift God could have ever given him. And for him to separate himself from her was an act of trust that, again, God intervened with him like he had intervened with Abraham and says, no, no, I don't want you to separate yourself. I want you to take her as your wife, and you will be the father of this child, not physically, of course, but spiritually, humanly, to take care of this child. You will name him Jesus, and you will serve in that role. So anyway, a number of different points there to connect him with, sure, with Abraham.
Great. In recent years, the Benedict option has become popular, and you have a chapter titled The Joseph Option. So what is the Joseph option?
Well, I was intentionally leaning on that popularity and awareness of the Benedict option. Rod Dreher simply points to Saint Benedict as an example for us to follow. And then he applies that in a number of very interesting and I think useful ways. My simple proposal is, well, Saint Benedict himself followed the example of Joseph. So maybe we should all do like Saint Benedict and take the Joseph option. So that's my little play on that. And I feel like as a Benedictine, I have a claim to stake in this question. And I really do see, first of all, a number of points of resonance in the rule of Benedict and the life of Joseph. And in a simple saying, it's simply that Benedict created a new Nazareth, that a Benedictine monastery is meant to be a new Nazareth. One of the keynotes of the rule of Benedict is that the divine presence is everywhere with us. Where is that the case more so than in Nazareth? Nazareth is truly the place where the divine presence was always there. And then Saint Benedict arranges the rule so that we're constantly running into the divine presence. He points out how it's in the bells that call us to prayer, how it's in the monk's dining room, and arranges their dining so that it's like the liturgy. He tells them that they should treat the tools of the workshed like the sacred vessels of the altar. He tells them to receive guests as Christ. He tells them to look to the abbot as another Christ. He tells them to look to see Christ in the sick and to see Christ in the young. He tells them that Christ is there and they're sleeping and they're waking. So really, the rule of Saint Benedict is oriented around helping the monk to be aware of the divine presence at all times. And that's something that Saint Joseph would have also had to do. Although we know the divine presence was always there, that's not obvious. He looks like a little boy. He looks like an infant. He looks like a young man. And to become aware of that, because we can know abstractly God is always with us, but how do I actually get in touch with that? And so that's something that Saint Joseph would have had to grow into, that Saint Benedict helps his monks to handle, and that anybody who's choosing the Benedict option should really look a little farther back to the Joseph option, okay, to get some insights on how to create an environment that we're like Saint Joseph, loving Our Lady and being attentive to the constant presence of Christ.
Great. Now, Father, the book's been out a few weeks. What's been the feedback that you received from it so far?
Wow, thanks for asking that. I've really had some wonderful feedback. A number of people have found it very readable, which I'm very happy about. I received one comment that I really loved. Someone who said, you know, there's a danger because there's not that much said about St. Joseph. You can kind of create your own St. Joseph. And he said, I feel like you have really received, you've tried to get to know him as he is, and you're not just sort of creating him in your own image, making him out what you want to be. And that's really important to me, because the book generated out of a journey, my own journey of getting to know him. As I was being ordained a deacon, I was kneeling there before a statue, but preparing for ordination, I was kneeling before a statue, and I realized I just didn't really know him. And I asked him, you know, please reveal yourself to me. I want to get to know you. And so this is really the journey without ever having any apparitions or any other kind of supernatural, extraordinary phenomena. I just have spent a lot of time in prayer, reading, reflection, and kind of looking for that resonance. And I wanted to get to know St. Joseph, and then I want to help other people get to know him. And that's the kind of feedback I've been getting. People feel like they get to know him. They're developing a relationship with him from people who are scholarly and have really, who are brilliant people and very holy people, from people who are very simple people and don't have a lot of background. I found a lot of positive feedback so far.
Great. And Father, where can people check out your book?
Well, you can go to the Emmaus Road website, which is located at stpaulcenter.com. And you can find Through the Heart of St. Joseph there. It's also available on Amazon and other major booksellers.
Great. Again, the book is called Through the Heart of St. Joseph. I highly recommend it. It's a great book. I said, easily readable, very understandable. Father, great job on the book. And thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm really grateful.
All right. God bless you.